Welcome to You Don't Even Like This Band, a podcast about bands you probably don't even like.
We hope you don't know this one.
With your hosts, Adam Todd Brown, Andy Sell, and Travis Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band, a.k.a. Over My Pod, a.k.a. Pusk. That's still my favorite one. We should have just called this podcast Pusk.
Pusk, yeah.
Pusk, I like it.
Yeah, yeah. We're back. It's been a bit. This is a hard podcast to research. I have to read, like, entire books. And, you know, I've read enough books that now we're here to talk about Rumors. I'm Adam Todd Brown. Did we introduce ourselves? No.
No.
No. Go for it.
I'm Adam Todd Brown.
I'm Travis fucking Clark, which I forgot was my nickname, but That's my nickname.
What's up, Puskers? It's Andy.
Okay, now we can carry on talking about Rumors. How's everyone doing?
Great, because I fucking love this record. I love it. I've listened to this a lot. I've listened to B-sides, I've listened to rarities, I've listened to demos, I've listened to outtakes. I love this record.
Yep, people can shit on it all they want and pretend it's like dad rock or whatever, but there's a reason Rumors sold the way it sold.
Wait,
it is.
Do people shit on this record? Because that would be insane to me.
Well, I feel like, and I brought this up when we started this podcast, I feel like Fleetwood Mac kind of gets lumped in with like the Eagles and that like... Yeah. 70s LA rock sound, but they're just so much better than that.
Yeah, well,
they're so much better than the fucking Eagles.
They're also kind of like what the 70s LA rock sound was trying to be, right?
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, I don't know. The people that would like shit on this, they're the same as like the people that shit on the Beatles to me, where it's like, yeah. I get it. You think you're controversial. That's fun.
Yeah.
People shit on the Beatles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You didn't know that?
That's a thing that comes in waves. Like,
yeah.
In the late 70s, there was a lot of anti-Beatles backlash when punk was happening. And, I mean, they get a lot of backlash for, like, you know, borrowing music from black musicians, if that's the way we want to say it. But so did every band back then.
Yeah, that was just what white music was just stealing black music.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
And Fleetwood Mac,
I don't want to get into it, but people that shit on the Beatles, it's just like, I get it. I get you associate bands like Fleetwood Mac or the Beatles or what have you with like the boomers. Sure.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know.
That's
it's
like
still
shitting
good.
On like, Mozart for being alive when he was alive. Like, who gives a shit, man? It's the product. It's not who was young when the person was making it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rumors really is one of the best rock albums of all time. It is a flawless album. There's not a song that's even sort of bad.
Yeah, there's not a dud on the record.
There's only one song that wasn't a radio hit on the whole album. That's
yeah,
Oh
and I
Daddy.
Think it's the one song that that's the song that I go to me. I don't think it's a bad song. It does feel out of place on this record.
Which one?
Oh Daddy.
Oh, yeah, it's But even that song is still great. Like, I would argue that there's not a song on this record that isn't great. Not just there's not a bad song. There's not a song that's even just good.
Yeah.
They're all, like, great.
Yeah, it's all singles. Pretty much every song, with the exception of Oh Daddy, probably could have been released as a single. And it was released at a time when radio DJs had a lot more leeway in what they would play. So this is an album that... There were DJs that would just put this album on and be like, we're listening to Rumors for the next 45 minutes. It's so good. And if you read about the production of it, like everything on that album sounds so clean and really straightforward. And then you look into the production and they're like breaking sheets of glass to make these sounds and banging on chairs. It's nuts.
Yeah, throwing tennis balls at harpsichords or whatever. They're doing all kinds of weird shit.
Hitting one of the Gallaghers in the head with a hammer.
Gallagher 2 has like a really good frequency if you hit him with a hammer, right? And I know it's kind of a pretentious thing to say, and it's a headphones album. Like, you should listen to this album with headphones. You can enjoy it over speakers in your car or whatever, but if you listen to it with a pair of headphones on, you can hear a lot of stuff that is just really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we last left off, they had just released the White Album, aka Fleetwood Mac.
I call it the Phantasm album.
Yeah, it has that look on the front cover.
Yeah.
Looks like the guy from Phantasm twice on that cover. Very weird. And the White Album, what's really unique about that album is how long it took to blow up. Like, when it was done, they thought it was going to do well, but it just, like, kept selling and selling and selling over the course of, like, 18 months. And that, in turn, one, made Warner Brothers, their record label, very happy. So they just slid a ton of money across the table to Fleetwood Mac. And it also gave them a lot of time to work. And you would think that would lead to a more relaxed atmosphere for the band. But nay.
Yeah, have you been paying attention to what these people have been doing the last four episodes of this podcast?
It's also, too, whenever there's that thing of like, we loved that last record, here's a bunch of money, go top it. Usually the response is, here's a shitty album nobody buys. That's usually what happens. I think this is one of the rare instances where they went, oh, you gave us time and money, we're going to give you an even better record.
This record is kind of like, it's like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre of classic rock, in that, like, it's just a perfect storm of ridiculous, fucked up conditions that created this masterpiece that you could never duplicate it again because the conditions were so uncanny, you know? Yeah. Like, it's not...
It's like one of those elements that only existed for a fraction of a second. It's like, yes, we blew up a nuclear bomb and we made this new element, but it doesn't exist anymore. We can't really do it again, and we don't actually know how we did it.
Yeah, it's like a Buddhist sand garden, you know, or sand mural. It's just like, the fact that the record, the White Album, that it took a while, and they were already in the writing and recording process of this record when that album made them all rich, and all of the relationship drama that was a part of it, and a fucking car accident, and like three different studios with increasingly different circumstances in the scenario. Like, it's just like, you can't duplicate that. That's a P.T. Anderson movie of nonsense creating this record.
Yeah, and it almost killed them making this album. Like,
it almost killed the record, too. Like, the record almost didn't happen.
Yeah, what's really crazy is you hear about Fleetwood Mac and all of this excess when it came to drugs. And we're actually not going to talk about a ton of that on these next couple episodes. And it's not because that stuff's not true. It's just, assume anything we talk about involves cocaine.
Yeah.
Like, that was Fleetwood Mac at the time. Like, yes, we're telling a fun story about them breaking glass to get drum sounds, but just assume they were also high at the time because they, at this point in history, are always partying.
Yeah, always. Most of the decisions that are made during this time, it's like, oh, this is a person on drugs.
Yeah.
None of this is like, oh, this person sat down and reasoned this out in their head and then made this decision. No, it's all just synapses firing as a result of drugs.
I mean, I've been wondering if we were ever going to cover the Fleetwood Enema. You all have heard of this, right?
I don't.
Is that a Kowlooning variation?
Kowlooning. I love it so much. I know what Travis is talking about.
The rumor is that Stevie Nicks.
I'm sorry, the
so
what? The what is?
The
what?
Rumor.
I was so confused, and I got it now. I get it now.
I'm sorry.
The rumor.
I am not on cocaine. I think that's the problem here.
Yeah. If you could just do a quick couple of quick bumps, maybe we could, it'll kind of level you off. The rumor is Stevie Nicks was such a frequent cocaine user that she could no longer do it up her nose because her nose was trashed. So Mick Fleetwood had to put it in a straw and blow it up her butthole.
You've never heard that rumor, Andy?
You know, it sounds a little familiar.
It's actually what Gold Dust Woman is about.
Yeah, Landslide was originally called Ass Slide.
Yeah.
People don't know that.
Rock on butthole cocaine.
Yeah, I don't know at what point the band gets to that, where Stevie Nicks is taking cocaine up the butthole, or if that part is even true. I know one thing that Travis just mentioned, that pressure to follow up your really huge album, a lot of times that pressure results in an album that doesn't sell that well. That's the next album we're going to talk about, which is Tusk. Which is, I think today, probably most Fleetwood Mac fans' like personal favorite Fleetwood Mac album. Because with Rumors, that goes without saying. Rumors is such a flawless piece of music that, like, that's an easy choice. But Tusk, they did a thing that I love. It's a thing Neil Young did in the 70s also, where they had this huge hit album and they make a conscious decision where they're like, that's not us. Like, that's not us as a band. We don't want to keep trying to recreate that. So they deliberately on Tusk make a way different album, and people didn't like it at the time.
Well, that's the, you know, you got two types of bands. You got your Fleetwood Macs who go, we're known for this, but we want to do this. And then you got your Sugar Rays who are like, we tried to be this, but you guys seem to like this, so we're going to make five more albums exactly like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love it anytime you get an opportunity to compare Fleetwood Mac to Sugar Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Mark McGrath clearly should be in the current version of Fleetwood Mac, as far as I'm concerned. Should be Fleetwood McGrath is what it should be.
Fleetwood Mark.
Fleetwood Mac. Oh, no. That's the new name of this podcast. So here's a quote from Mick Fleetwood about the recording process of Rumors. Arrgh, it's been documented to death, so I'll say it briefly. I'm not going to do the pirate voice the whole time. This is a long quote.
I forgot he's a pirate. I always forget about the pirate voice for him.
Arrgh. Here's the quote. It's been documented to death, so I'll say it briefly. But the making of Rumors almost killed us. Physically? Not really. The myths of excess you've all heard are true, and the truth is that we'd all be dead already if we weren't made of stronger stuff. What nearly did us in was the way we handled our emotions as our personal relationships came apart. And here's another quote. I don't know why I didn't just combine this. By the time we set about writing for Rumors, we had all fallen to pieces. After 7 years, John and Christine called it quits. Lindsay and Stevie's four-year relationship was over, and my marriage to Jenny on its way to divorce. And so then everyone in that quote, except Jenny, has to come together and make an album. That's one of the other really crazy things about this. It's not just that the sessions dragged on so long. It's not that I think at the time it was the most expensive album ever made. It's that everyone clean fucking hated each other.
Yeah.
At various points.
And was high. Yes. And hate.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everybody in here is like romantically involved with another person in the band, but cheating on them with someone else and making the other person pay for a lot of shit.
And then writing songs about it.
Writing songs about it, doing every drug you can think of, and having jam sessions that go till like 4 a.m. And one of them is a fifth wheel. Like, that's the other thing, is that you look at the album cover or the back album cover for this record, and it's like Mick Fleetwood is just like a goon in every photo, just like standing apart from everybody and making faces. And it's like, yeah, I'm in a messy relationship too, but she's not in the band, so I'm just going to be here and feel awkward.
Right, yeah. But he's also a 9-foot-tall pirate. Like, you can't, there's not a lot of photo ops for that guy.
Yeah, he is also a goat-eating ogre.
He does guard a bridge, and you have to answer questions if you come across him.
And we already touched on one of the sources of tension in our last episode, which was a bonus episode about the lovely and talented and recently deceased Christine McVie.
Might I say that it is a perfect bonus episode?
Whoa, I get it, because her last name's Perfect, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Now I get it. I just thought Andy was being very full of himself.
But it was also a perfect episode, absolutely.
Yeah, it was pretty flawless.
Yeah, it's about you guys, not me.
Yeah, because we all hated each other at the time, because we'd all just broken up, and we had came together just high out of our minds and just talked about what was on our mind.
So much cocaine.
Oh, my God.
Also, people at home, I don't care how cool Fleetwood Mac makes it seem, don't do cocaine right now. Very bad time. Very bad time to be doing cocaine.
Unless it's free. If you can get it for free.
Yeah, just don't pay for it.
Don't pay for it.
So on that last episode, we talked about how You Make Love and Fun, which is one of Christine McVie's biggest hits, was actually about the guy she was cheating on her husband, John McVie, with. And it turns out, as we mentioned on the last episode, that man was Fleetwood Mac's lighting director. What we didn't mention was his name, which I found in this book, Curry Grant. That sounds fake, right?
That sounds like the name of a drag king whose shtick is being into South Asian cuisine.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds like somebody who was like, had like a tongue swelling and trying to say Cary Grant. It's like, yeah, his name is Cary Grant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. No, but it's Cary Grant. It's a drag king who's like, I lip sync over scenes from Cary Grant movies.
Yeah.
But yeah. I also cook Indian food while I do it.
Cary Grant seems like a hipster Indian restaurant in Deep Hollywood.
Oh my God. 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
And as is always the case, when a higher up engages in a sexual relationship with a subordinate, Cary Grant was the one who got fired for this. Although, how funny would it be if they fired Christine McVie and kept Cary Grant?
They're like, look, babe, your songs are good. You got a great voice, but nobody lights like Cary Grant.
You think I can just throw a stick and hit another Cary Grant? You're crazy. There's only one Cary Grant.
There are a million Christine Perfects in the world.
I had a friend in South Dakota who was in a band, and at one point he was doing a show and their lighting guy got sick, and he was like, hey, you want to run lights tonight? It's like, I don't fucking know how to do that. And he was like, yeah, you'll figure it out. I did not. I did not do it. I didn't.
I ran sound for an entire run of a play because they went, hey, you like sound. And so he's like, well, yeah, I guess, sure. And then they start talking to you in like technical terms, and you're like, I don't know what any of that is. Tell me what button to push.
I will say, yes, running sound, I think everybody that's ever done it, it's because they were just put in front of a mixer at one point and they're like, here, do it.
Yeah.
And eventually you kind of start to understand it.
So I would assume lighting is the same way. So
yeah, maybe
you could be the next Cary Grant, Adam. I should have done it.
Yeah, we might be talking about how you ruined Fleetwood Mac if you've done that, you know?
Here's a quote from Mick Fleetwood about Cary Grant. We confronted Chris about it, friend to friend, and she told us the truth. She understood that we had to fire Cary, which we did, even though we didn't want to because he did a great job. Getting rid of him didn't make things any better, however. Once it was out in the open and beyond a shadow of a doubt, John was even more upset because it was clear to him that Chris didn't want Cary to go.
What if they'd fired John McVie instead?
That would have also been a bold move.
I like the idea where they sit Cary down and they go, Cary, we have great news. You did. You did make Love and Fun. And we really are grateful for that.
Yeah.
However, your position has been eliminated. Please see HR on the way out.
Yeah.
I mean,
like it's see ya, bud. Also, the moral of the story, don't have an adulterous relationship with the star of the thing you're working for.
Oh, that's, come on. You
it's
know,
it's going to work out for you.
If you're Cary Grant in that situation, you're sleeping with Christine McVie.
You're not going to not sleep with Christine McVie. I'm sorry. That's just the way that goes. We're all helpless in that situation.
Then I think maybe the lesson we can take from this is don't write a song about it.
Yeah. That, yes.
Also, don't make the song so pointedly, like, the lyrics to that song are, right, it's you, and I don't even have to tell you, you're the only one. The lyrics to that song are literally, my husband can't make me come, but you, Cary Grant, do.
The title of that song should be, you make cheating with my husband fun.
Yeah.
You, Cary Grant, make cheating on my husband, John McVie, rewarding because he can't make me come.
And then if you listen to the demo version, there's that whole fourth verse that's just about stage lighting. It's like, what is happening here? That is odd. So one thing that shocked me, this is mentioned in Mick Fleetwood's book. He says there was never even sort of a point during these recording sessions that the band thought about breaking up.
That's the crazy part of all of this.
And I think you have to just attribute that to the point in history when this happened. They've just released the White Album. They've all been like toiling in music for years. And now the White Album is taken off and they realize this is probably the thing. Like, this is how our dreams come true, and we just have to fucking see it through.
Yeah, I mean, I can actually, it kind of makes sense to me. Like, if you've put that much time and effort into it and it's paying off, you can go, I can get another spouse. Mm-hmm. I can't make this happen again, well, you know?
Also, at this point, the band is already not just a band, but an institution with a legacy where like multiple people have come and gone throughout this thing. Like,
and haven't we
it's
already
a company
had-
unto itself.
Haven't we already had like two Fleetwood Mac spinoffs that tried to fake Wood Max? Haven't there been
two? Like, that's the other thing, is there have been two fake Wood Max already. Like, you can't just turn your back on this. This is where you work now. It's Fleetwood Mac is the company that you work for at this point.
The making of Rumors should be a movie. It would be
really should.
Really, really solid feature film.
Yeah. Because also, the fact that these are musicians that have years of experience of like following their dreams for no rewards under their belt, like they're not kids that just suddenly got famous. Like these were all folks in a band that just started and then like overnight success, they would already be broken up. This absolutely would have broken them up. But because they all were like, I don't want to go back to, you know, bartending or whatever the fuck else I was doing before this.
Cleaning houses,
Or mooching off of my wife who cleans houses.
Right. But also, too, they're like, at this point, they're like, you know, we've had two people have psychotic breaks / religious awakenings. We can probably get through this, right?
Yeah. Two people have left this band for Jesus already. Like,
this band did know turmoil before this. That is for sure.
But what I think is so crazy to me for my experience with Fleetwood Mac, this is where I thought Fleetwood Mac started. Like, I kind of viewed this as like their first or second album until we started doing this. And I'd heard like, oh, they used to be a blues band. That's all I knew. I didn't know any of this stuff that we had covered until now.
Yeah. And it gets crazier. But before we get there, we have to introduce a new character into the story.
Oh, shit.
Fleetwood Mac's Rumors album is co-produced by two men, Ken Kallay and Richard Dashett. And Ken Kallay wrote a book about the making of Rumors, and he wrote a book about the making of Tusk. And I would argue his book about the making of Rumors is probably the definitive source for information. For one thing, if you're a gearhead at all, if you're way into the actual recording process that happens in a studio, you will fucking love this book.
I am getting this book.
He goes into so much detail about the recording of each song, and it's interesting, but also not the kind of interesting that would translate to a general Fleetwood Mac information podcast like this. So
Of
it, you're going to have to read the book to hear about it.
Yeah. If maybe you've wondered if you have ADHD and you find this super, super fascinating, one, might want to talk to a doctor, and two, pick up the book.
Yeah, it's a good book.
The other thing is, I bet like all the other people in this band, they were all, you know, on every drug. I don't know what Ken's drug intake was. I don't know what his regimen consisted of.
Ken was pretty fucked up, but not,
I'm sure
not
was,
to the extent the band was.
I'm sure it was less than everyone else involved. So if anyone has a memory to be considered reliable, it's probably old Kenny Boy.
Yeah.
Well, he was also on probably the perfect combo of drugs to go, I should be writing this down, man. And so, like, you know, that's how we get the book.
Yeah, we mentioned on a previous episode that one of the reasons the White Album blew up is because they took the song Rhiannon and remixed it specifically for car stereo speakers. Ken Kallay is the guy that did that remix. And that's how he ended up working with them on the Rumors album. So a lot of what we know about those sessions comes from him. If you read Mick Fleetwood's book, he really kind of glosses over the Rumors recording session. And it's like, I wonder why. It's because of all the cocaine, probably.
He might just be, I mean, we already have photos of him just gooning in the background. It might be, all I know is those photos and the songs. I don't remember how they happened.
Fun side note about Ken Kallay, he is the father of pop singer Kobe Kallay, who, you remember her, she had that hit a couple years ago.
I don't.
Nope. What was it?
I had no idea.
Kobe Kallay sounds like another Curry Grant kind of name. Like, it's one of those, what witness relocation thing are you in where this is your name?
Yeah, I don't even remember what her big fucking hit was. What was it? Bubbly? I don't think I know any goddamn Kobe Kallay songs. Never mind.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen this person's name before.
Like, I recognize the name. I know she had some hits in the 2000s. But her dad, famous music producer. So he wrote this book. And here's the thing. She wrote the intro to the book. Like, she wrote the foreword. But I imagine her reading this book had to be a lot of, Dad, you're embarrassing me energy.
I mean, that's just the nature of being the child of someone, right? But then if someone's like, I did all these drugs and made this famous record, you're like, oh God, Dad, stop it.
Well, it's not
stop
just
doing
that.
Cocaine and making such famous songs.
Boy, does he go into detail about all the pretty girls he boned. At this point,
yeah, probably not an easy read for a daughter.
I don't know what you're talking about. I love it when my mom sits me down and says, well, first there was Gary, and he was blonde, and his dick
I'll
compared
never
to your
forget
father's
my
was...
first throat pie. I tell you, it was such an amazing time for me because you find you can ingest more semen if it's just shooting straight into your esophagus.
Wow.
Dad, stop. Yeah, he had to have kept a journal or something around this time. Either that or he's just making all this shit up because he has such intricate and detailed knowledge of these recording sessions, like dates and times, everything.
You know, he could be making it up because if everybody else there was out of their mind, they're just going to go, yeah, it sounds right.
I don't know.
Sounds like something I'd do. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that really stands out about this book, he does a great job of capturing just the intense amount of labor that went into making this album. If I recall correctly, I do believe this was the most expensive album ever made at the time. And also the time it took. Like, they worked on this album for a fucking year. And that's rare. I know it happens from time to time, but especially back then when bands were cranking out albums like 2 and 3 a year, for a band to take a year to work on an album, it was unprecedented. And there are so many stories about the things this guy did to make this album happen. And one of the ones that really stands out to me is he tells this story about when they had gotten the album to the point that they were pressing the vinyl masters to go out and make all the copies. Because of pre-orders, they had to make like more than 100 vinyl masters to send out to the record plants. And he's like overseeing that process. And as they make each one, they have to package it up to ship it off to a place. Apparently records have to be dipped in something. And
chocolate and peanuts. Yeah.
Yeah. Caramel, stuff like that. Toffee.
Nougat. Yeah.
And he's in there watching them do this. And at one point it dawns on him that they're packaging these up and leaving them in this really cold room where all this is happening. And he asks someone if that's going to impact the sound quality. And this guy's like, not that much. And Ken Kalay was like, wait, not that much. So it is going to impact the sound quality.
I'm on just enough cocaine to be worried about this.
And that's the thing. Like, I do think cocaine had a lot to do with it. I think they were paranoid about this album turning out the way they wanted it to turn out. And I think all of those little things play into why it sounds the way it does.
That's the other thing, right? If everyone's relationship is falling apart during the process of this, they're going to be like, well, this is literally the only thing I have. It can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I sacrificed for this? It can't just be slightly not what I want.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like if Tom Brady doesn't win a Super Bowl this year. It's like, you gave up Giselle for this? Jesus Christ, dude. But so what Ken Kalay ends up doing, like, he finds out that there is a slight chance that this process is going to impact sound quality. So he finds out that there's another record plant just like down the street that they can take these records to and have that process done. And so he makes a bunch of phone calls, and then he and the co-producer spend the rest of the day driving records down to this place to have them dipped as soon as they're printed. And he says in the book that maybe impacted sound quality by like 5%. But even then, he's like, worth it. Absolutely.
Argue with the results. Yeah. Argue with the results. Stack up enough 5% and, you know, you got 100%.
Yeah.
Also, maybe Rich and Ken just liked the time they got to spend together. You know, maybe they just had really great talks in the car on the way.
Maybe they were like, dude, these guys are fucking killing me. Let's say that there's a problem with the records and let's leave and go dip the records down the street for a while where we can just get a break from this chaos.
We're just going to get 8 hours away from these fucks every day. And it's fine because they're sleeping for those 8 hours from their jam sessions the night before anyway.
All of that, but just about Lindsey Buckingham is what you find reading this book. Everyone else in the band seems like they were pretty cool. John McVie seems like he was a problem, but he would go home and be a problem. Like, he would just show up and play a bunch of grumpy bass and then leave. But, like, Lindsey Buckingham, he is the hero and villain both of the Rumors story, because he's such a genius when it comes to music. Like, it's more than just him being a really great guitar player. Like, they actually go into his guitar playing process in this book, and he plays guitar in a way that most people don't. Like, he has his nails trimmed in a specific way so he can play like he plays a really intricate version of fingerstyle guitar that most people
flamenco.
Don't do.
Doesn't do flamenco stuff with like his little almond shaped fingers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But he's also kind of a piece of shit during.
Yeah, he's a ridiculous cartoon monster in every
other
way.
Have you noticed that every band we've covered, there's like, man, I love this record, or I love this band. And then you're like, and here's the people who made it. Well, it turns out they're a real piece of shit. Like, yeah, that's everybody we've ever covered.
Yeah, feels like it. Except Limp Bizkit, obviously.
I was going to say Korn. Korn. The guys in Korn seem fine.
Yeah, against all odds, they do seem like the coolest bunch of people we've covered.
Of the bands we've talked about, the members of Korn have committed fewest sins.
Absolutely the ones I would most want to hang out with.
However, I would like to refresh everyone's memory of Korn Coffee.
Oh, good. You know what? I can still taste it. And you're right. That is a crime.
But that hoodie, so soft. So soft.
It is a crime with a K and a backwards R. Yeah, we didn't all get to get hoodies, though, Adam.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I bought it. Like, you could bought one if you wanted.
Yeah, are you serious that we couldn't get them to sponsor us?
No, I reached out.
We didn't
out
like
Korn
their product,
not.
And I hated their band. Why would they sponsor us?
Your band fucking sucks, and your coffee is a crime. Do you want to sponsor a podcast?
Free advertisement, bro.
No such thing as bad press.
So, one of the defining characteristics of the Rumors album is that it was recorded in about 1,000 different recording studios. And part of that has to do with, because the White Album was blowing up while they're recording this album, they had to go out and tour a bunch. So they would take breaks in recording, and they'd sometimes record on the road. But all of that recording started at a place called the Record Plant in Sausalito, California. And let me tell you, I want to live at the Record Plant. It sounds amazing.
Field trip. Let's go.
This is a quote from Mick Fleetwood. I knew there was only one way for this to work. We had to get out of LA and live together the way we had at Kiln House after Peter left. Because once again, we were in a critical condition. I'd heard great things about the Record Plant in Sausalito across the bay from San Francisco.
What? I mean, that thinking is so fucking backwards to most people. Like, we all hate each other and we're about to not be a band anymore. You know what we need to do is become roommates.
It is weird.
Andy, we need to have a baby to save the marriage. That's what they're doing.
Kinda, yeah.
What does the fucking chore wheel at this place look like?
Oh, no one's doing chores at this house. Are you insane?
Yeah.
Ah, it's my turn to blow cocaine up Stevie's ass again.
This is a millionaire's flop house. Like, you come in there and it just smells like shit and PCP. And you're like, holy God, what happened in here?
Yeah, this is another quote from the book. And I think this kind of says everything you need to know about what kind of place the Record Plant was. This is Mick Fleetwood again. The studio was a great place to record, but truthfully, it was very odd. It had opened in 1973 and was designed to fulfill the expectations of a music industry at the height of excess. It came complete with 2 custom limos to transport recording musicians wherever they might want to go, a speedboat for their use, a conference room with a waterbed floor. There were tanks of industrial-grade nitrous oxide on hand, and then there was the pit, which had been designed by Sly Stone, who recorded the album fresh there. Let's talk about the pit.
I will say,
are there monsters in it?
Yes. Both times I read this, I read that as Sly Stallone, and I'm like, that's crazy, dude. Like, why did Sylvester Stallone design a pit in a recording studio? Oh, Sly Stone.
Frank Stallone recorded there, though.
Oh my God. I did a deep dive on some Frank Stallone songs not too long ago because I watched Rambo and he has the closing credits song. Oh my God.
Good stuff. I bet.
I tell you what, if we're going to do a season on Frank Stallone, it should be called Nobody Even Likes This Band. And that would be how we review.
I lived with a guy who was a bandmate of Frank Stallone for a little bit. And he was an interesting character.
I bet. Speaking of interesting, let's talk about The Pit. This was a studio in the record plant in Sausalito where Sly Stone had designed this. And it was a 10-foot sunken pit in the middle of the floor. And the intention was that the engineer would be down there and the musicians would stand around him overlooking the pit. And then he would be able to hear everything in 360 degrees. It's like, why not just put him in the middle and have everything?
Yeah. Also too, like, sound doesn't fall like cold air. Like it's just going to go over you. It sounds like I'm in the basement and there's a band rehearsing on top of me.
Travis,
what it sounds like.
If you do enough drugs, you can get the music to go downwards.
And
you just have to get high enough to transcend physics.
And it turns out he ended up just really liking the way his instrument sounded when he played down there. So it just turned into another studio. Like, they never actually used it for what Sly Stone intended it for. So by the time Fleetwood Mac got there, it was mostly used as a quiet place to do cocaine, which shouldn't surprise anyone.
Like a little coke lounge.
Yeah. A 10-foot coke pit.
And you could just sit there and be like, hey, I'm going to figure out this guitar part while I look down at you snorting drugs.
I don't know how you got down there, but I hope it was a rope.
Mick can't get out of the pit again.
You just have to climb it like in high school gym class.
Or like one of those things, like you see them up at certain malls where they're supposed to simulate skydiving by those crazy fans. You do blow and you get blown out of the pit. Like, that's how you leave.
The description of this place, it's like a horror movie set. Like, first of all, how did they not die with a waterbed floor room and a speedboat at their disposal? How do you survive that?
This is for sure a Saw movie. You know, it's like, do you want to make a record?
I want the movie that's made about this recording process to be a horror movie at this point that just involves them dying by limousine, speedboat, and nitrous oxide.
I think speedboat is like a boat you take to get speed. I don't think it's like a fast boat.
It's not even a boat. It's just a wooden raft where Mick Fleetwood would do amphetamines.
And fire a cannon. For sure he's firing a cannon off of the bow.
Oh, he's got a little pirate flag on there.
Yeah.
So I forgot one more defining characteristic of the pit. There was also a loft area that was accessible through a large pair of red lips that had a bed in it with audio jacks next to it. So if you wanted, you could perform your vocals laying in bed.
This sounds like something out of the Milk Bar from Clockwork Orange.
There's like a jazz record. I want to say it's, I don't know, I want to say Stanley Turrentine, but it might be Freddie Hubbard. But there's like a jazz record that has a guy laying on a lip bed. I'm wondering if it's the same. It's probably not the same.
Just like the idea that they're like, you know, not everybody who worked on this record is going to be in standing shape. So you might want to give them a place to lay down so that they can lay down their track.
It is hard to stand when you have an eight ball just blown up your rectum.
So let's talk about Jenny. Poor Jenny.
Is this Jenny Boyd?
Mm-hmm. As has been documented and mentioned lots of times already by us and history both, these recording sessions were just dripping with tension and discomfort. And in the early stages, it was Mick Fleetwood's wife, Jenny, who suffered the hardest. For starters, Mick Fleetwood mentions there was a point where she was so stressed, her shoulder blades started protruding out of her back. And she like went to a doctor and they were like, calm down. That's why it's happening. You're too stressed.
Oh, we've seen this before. This is "You're Married to Someone in Fleetwood Mac Disorder." Yes. Yeah.
Perosis. Yeah,
a symptom of being with a member of Fleetwood Mac is your skeleton gets fucked up.
And apparently it just like righted itself eventually. It just like popped back into place when she cooled out a little bit, baby. But there is also a wild story about how Jenny, she comes to visit Mick Fleetwood at the record plant in Sausalito. And at one point, she's in the passenger seat of John McVie's car, which is being driven by a friend of hers. They're taking it back to Los Angeles, at least they were supposed to. And the woman driving, her name's Sandra, she breaks the unfortunate news to Jenny during this car trip that Mick Fleetwood has been cheating on her and has been seeing another woman at the studio. At the moment this news is delivered, the car they're driving in is just fucking T-boned by another car. Like, hey, your husband's cheating on you, and then that movie thing where you look and there's a car.
Yeah, exactly, where it's coming from the background through the driver's side window. Yeah.
It's also like, oh man, the news hit me like a freight truck. And then I was hit by a freight truck. You know, like
this is a quote from Mick Fleetwood. "I remember hearing about all of this and thinking that Jenny was literally falling apart."
Yeah, because of you.
He's like, damn, also, she's having a rough go of things, huh?
I remember hearing about that.
We're trying to find the guy who did this.
So like any good husband, he initiated divorce proceedings shortly thereafter.
"Listen, while you're hooked up to all of those breathing machines, would you mind just making a little X on this little paper here? It says we severed our relationship."
I wonder, did the car crash pop her shoulder blade back into place? Is that what happened?
Maybe.
The car crash was rough, but try being married to Mick Fleetwood.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam, host of the podcast you're listening to right now. Just dropping in to let you know that if you're enjoying this Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band, but would prefer to hear it without annoying ads like this one, head on over to youdontpod.supercast.com and sign up for the You Don't Even Like This Band Backstage Pass for just $4 a month. Not only do you get ad-free episodes, you get access to an absolute litany of bonus episodes that you can't hear anywhere else. But wait, there's more. Subscribers also already have access to the entirety of the second Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band. And since we finished that, we've put up a bunch of bonus episodes, and we're gearing up to start a new season about a completely different band that you don't even like. There's a lot to listen to, and you can listen to it all for just four little dollars a month. Head to youdontpod.supercast.com and sign up for that or any of our other subscription options and start listening right away. And thanks. We love you. Let's get back to the podcast. So, as I've mentioned, Mick Fleetwood really kind of glosses over the rumors recording sessions in his book. And it might be because the Ken Kelay book was already out and had documented all of that.
It might be the cocaine.
Or it might be he was working on his percussion vest during this time. Yeah. That was like really what was taking up the majority of his, you know.
Well, that's also bandwidth. How he writes. He's got a keyboard vest.
I recorded the sound of my wife's car getting hit by a truck. And now it happens when you hit my right nipple.
One of these triggers makes my wife get hit by a car.
It's my kick drum on rumors it is.
He's the jigsaw figure in the movie, and his percussion vest just operates a different trap.
So, whereas Mick Fleetwood glosses over the recording sessions for rumors, Ken Kelay's book, which is appropriately titled Making Rumors, does the exact opposite. It really gets into a lot of detail.
The rumors mill was right there for the taking.
Right?
Or rumors has it, you know, whichever you want to do.
Big missed opportunity.
Seriously.
I think you should write him, Andy. I think you should let him know your opinion on what his title should have been.
Ken, if you're listening, I've got notes.
I'm tapping them out on my percussion vest. So he talks a lot about how he ended up working with Fleetwood Mac, and, you know, read the book if you're interested. They basically just reached out. And like I said, he did that remix of Rhiannon. So when it came time to record Rumors, they called up Ken Kallay. He started as just the engineer, though. He doesn't become the producer until later. But one of the first things that happens in this book, all the musicians start showing up at the studio to record with Ken. And the first person who shows up is Stevie Nicks. And Ken says, "Hi, Lindsay. I'm a big fan."
Oh.
Like, that is such a bare minimum amount of research.
But also, I can understand it. If there's a Stevie and a Lindsay, you're going to go, well, the guy's Stevie and the girl's Lindsay. That also would be my thought.
Also, in his defense, and he mentions this in the book, if you look at the Buckingham Nicks album cover, Stevie Nicks is under where it says Buckingham, and Lindsay Buckingham is under where it says Nicks. And then the drummer is off to the side with a minus sign over his head.
And Kurt's there holding a shotgun. You're like, what the fuck? That is foreshadowing.
So these sessions start with them trying to get Mick Fleetwood's drum sound right. It took 5 days. That sounds so excruciating to me, because it's not like, you know, they didn't just like pop into the studio for an hour a day and be like, ah, let's try again fresh tomorrow. This was like 8 to probably 12 hours a day of just hitting the drum and trying to get it to sound right.
And then going, you know what we need? We need a little more cocaine. That'll help us to hear the right sound. You know,
that is cocaine behavior if I've ever heard it.
We can do better. We can do better. We can do better. Oh my God, dude.
And then there's all the intra-band drama. One of the earliest incidents Ken Kallay documents is one involving John and Christine McVie. They were both dating new people by the time these sessions commenced, even though they're still married. John was dating a girl named Sandra. Christine was still dating Curry Grant.
Is that the Sandra that was driving?
Yeah.
Almost certainly, yeah.
Yeah, so the same Sandra was driving John's car. Yeah, right. That would make sense for her to be driving Jenny John's car if she was,
And at one point, they both bring their new romances to the studio, and an argument breaks out, and Christine McVie says to John McVie, "I don't have a problem with you bringing Sandra here. Why should you have a problem with me bringing Curry here?" To which John McVie fucking replies, "Yeah, but Sandra means nothing to me." He says that in front of her.
That's sitcom shit.
It is.
This, when I read this, made me laugh so, I mean, it's terrible, but it made me laugh so hard, because you're like, oh, well, clearly she wasn't in there. Oh, she's right there.
This story is full of moments that if they were in a movie, I would be like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
stop it. That didn't happen.
And to add to the movie quality of it all, she immediately stands up and chucks a glass of champagne in his face. And then is gone forever.
I mean, this is some Real Housewives shit at this point.
Yeah, this is insane.
One thing you'll definitely take away from the Ken Kallay book, we've already hinted at it. Lindsay Buckingham.
There are no heroes in this story? Is that what you take away from it?
Heroes are hard to find, right? Huh? It's the name of the Fleetwood Mac album. Lindsay Buckingham is a big, big problem at this point in history. It comes up first when he offhandedly mentions that the Stevie Nicks song Gold Dust Woman is sort of about how controlling Lindsay Buckingham was.
Dude, yeah. Like, when you listen to that song again, you're like, oh, this is not... I'll wait till we get a little further along. But yeah
no,
that song adds a whole other meaning to it once you're like, oh, that's what that's about.
Yeah, yeah, it's dark.
Which is pretty much every song on the record, honestly.
That's true. No, no question.
But early in the book, he kind of drops that thread. He just like hints, you're going to hear some uncomfortable things about Lindsay Buckingham. And then he moves on to The Transcension. The Transcension is a big aspect of the Fleetwood Mac Rumors recording process. It refers to that point where late at night, the band would just be so high that they would just start jamming for like hours on end. This is a quote. "Mick was the worst influence. He always made the excuse that genius music would come out of the Transcensions, but it never did. Maybe that was because the whole band was rarely there for most Transcensions. Just the coked up crazies. Mick and usually Stevie or Christine. If Mick could get either of them tooted up enough, then off the deep end we'd go. Very rarely would Lindsay fall for the late nights, and John never did.
I have to read this book. He said tooted up enough. Like, that right there is just beautiful.
I will say, jam sessions themselves probably never led to anything, you know, genius or whatever. But sometimes people that are this fucked up, it's like you got to just let them go and get shit out of their system so that when it's time to record, it's all worked out and they can do the actual good stuff.
Sure. Yeah. But have you ever been to a jam band concert?
Yes. Exactly. You don't want to see it, but they need to do it so that they can do the stuff you do want to see.
Right. But the only way to enjoy that is to also be taking similar things to what they're taking.
Oh, for sure.
Like, you can't just stand there and watch someone jam for 4 hours and enjoy it. Like, you're very much going to hate it.
For sure. Right. And I do love that in this particular arrangement, it's Stevie and Christine that are the ones that are down for it. Like, Lindsay and John can't hang. I love that. I love that, like, Stevie and Christine are like, oh, we're fucking hardcore. We'll do this shit.
I like that. I think John is just being like, I shouldn't have said that thing. I shouldn't have said.
One of the problems these transcensions would bring on is something Ken Kelly refers to as the 12-hour rule, which is that with musicians, once they leave the studio, you are not going to see them again for at least 12 hours.
Oh, God.
No matter what time of day the session ends. So these transcensions would start happening later and later at night to the point where they're finishing at like 4 and 5 in the morning. And he's like, all right, we're not going to see Christine McVie for another 12 hours. And it would happen every time.
What a nightmare. And this is like 9 months of their lives this goes on?
It took a year. Like, they start recording Rumors in January 1976. And I think they finished in January 77.
They recorded it like 5 different studios or something. So I'm imagining they're carrying this behavior with them.
Oh, yeah.
To every studio, regardless of whether or not there's a waterbed room or a speedboat involved.
Right.
They're still doing this.
Or a room that you have to walk through giant lips to get into to lay down.
Yeah. Or a coke pit or 2 limousines. Coke pit.
Can we open a place called the coke pit?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but it's a soda shop.
It's just cherry coke. Yeah.
Another thing that made the sessions drag on, here's a quote from Ken Kelly. The peculiar thing was that in the studio, sadness seemed to be contagious. If one band member was breaking up, then it made them all think about breaking up. And the first breakup was Jenny and Mick, for obvious reasons. That happened really early in the recording sessions for Rumors. This is another quote. We already had tears in the studio, and Mick hadn't even opened his first beer yet. And the reason for those tears, even though Mick Fleetwood is being a terrible husband at this point, he's also very sad that Jenny is having an affair with Bob Weston.
The guitar player?
The same Bob Weston she had an affair with before, who it turns out is one of Mick Fleetwood's best friends.
The guy that kicked out of the band because he did it, right? Wasn't he a guitar player?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, why not?
In his book, Mick Fleetwood's like, it sucked, but if anyone's going to be banging my wife, I guess I'd prefer it's my best friend, because at least I trust that guy. It's like,
fair.
What?
Fair. Want it to be a friend, not just someone who does lighting for your band.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want it to be an employee. You want it to be somebody who is emotionally betraying both of you.
He also tells this really great story about Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, where they're recording their backing vocals for the song You Make Love and Fun, which, first of all, go listen to that song and just key in on the vibe of that song. Very upbeat. It's very fun, very happy song. They're recording their background vocals, and Ken Kelly says everything seemed cordial and normal. And then he paused to rewind the tape, at which point Stevie just looks at Lindsay and screams, fuck you, asshole. You can go to hell. To which Lindsay replied, when we get back to LA, I'm moving out. And then he starts recording again, and they just like nail their fucking background vocals.
That's what you call a fucking professional.
Yeah.
But that's, again, another movie moment. It's like, okay, we're going to play back. Fuck you. You get out of it. Fuck you. And we're back in 2, 3, 4. Just right back into the song.
I want the version of Gold Dust Woman that has that audio in it.
That is Gold Dust Woman. That's Gold Dust Woman. That's the song.
Yeah, but it's what's funny is this song that they're doing this on, one, it's they're doing backing vocals. They're not even like the singers of the song. And it's not the song that's about either of them. This unrest is so contagious that even the song that's not about either of them, they're like, well, we're going to scream at each other during this.
Yeah. And yeah, again, as I mentioned, there's so much detail about the recording of these songs, and it's all very interesting, but it's also so intricate that going through it all on the podcast would take forever, and I don't think translate that well. But one of the examples he brings up, Songbird, which is one of the songs on this album, not recorded in a studio. It was recorded at the Zellerbach Auditorium in Berkeley, California.
How many limos they got there? How many coke pits?
All the coke pits. They're lined with the Communist Manifesto.
Oh, that's right. It's Berkeley.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a quote. I had made special arrangements at the Zellerbach Auditorium for March 3rd, 1976. I wanted the orchestral shell placed on stage to project the sound of the 9-foot Steinway piano out into the empty hall. I had also rented 8 $3,000 classic tube microphones and placed them throughout the auditorium to pick up the lovely nuances of the piano. Then, as a surprise for Christine, I had requested that a bouquet of roses be placed on her piano with 3 colored spotlights to illuminate them from above. I really wanted to set the mood. End quote. God damn, there was a lot of cocaine happening.
Yeah, also, I feel like he was like, the last lighting guy kind of got this. This worked for him. Maybe.
Well, they've also grown up. They've grown up a little bit with the excess of their drug. It's not a dildo on stage anymore. It's a bouquet of roses on the piano, which is not, I mean, come on. Who doesn't want that
if you're recording
an album?
There's an early take of this, and knowing that is actually really interesting because it starts with Christine saying, well, let's just roll tape and see what we get. So it's clearly just, you know, they banged it out probably 3 or 4 times and used one of those takes, and that's what's on the record.
Yeah. And that brings us to a good stopping point for this episode. I thought we were going to get through this in 2 episodes, and that is not seeming likely. We have at least 1 more episode about Rumors coming. But I feel like it's going to drag on into like 3 or 4. But we'll see. We'll see.
I have a question.
Okay.
I remember you sent us something a while ago before we were doing this. We mentioned that it was like nitrous oxide at this recording studio. Uh-huh. Did they flood the pit with nitrous oxide, or did I make that story up in my head where like they would just like make the pit some like big huffing spot?
I think you made that up.
Okay.
I mean, that would turn the coke pit into a nitrous pit.
Yeah. It's true. You just sit there like, I think we should record that song again.
So, do we have any final thoughts on Rumors before we continue with our thoughts on the next episode?
I mean, look, it's not a repeatable event, but you can't argue with the results, in my opinion. All of this is chaos. All of this is crazy. All of this is like the most 70s way to make a record, but it's a great record.
It's such an amazing record.
Yeah, it's a terrific record, and there's not... Again, I don't think there's even just a good song on it. Even the song, like, I'm sure we'll get into this, but there's a song that, like, I can't even listen to on this record anymore because it's just forever ruined by me. But even that song, I listen to it, and I'm like, still a great song.
Yeah.
I don't know why, other than the fact that it's a great song, but Gold Dust Woman, that's the one it's the perfect closer to it. And knowing what we know about it, that is, in my opinion, Stevie Nicks telling, you know, oh, did I make you cry? Did I break your heart? Fuck you, get your shit and go home. And he's just arguing with guitar. That's all I hear now when I hear that song.
And that song, you're right that it's the perfect ending for that album because there was so much chaos that went into making this album. And the end of Gold Dust Woman is fucking lunacy.
Yeah.
Like there is so much happening. And yeah, we'll talk about it again on the next episode. But there's a point in that song where you hear like werewolves howling. That's the band. They were just so fucking out of their minds that they were like, let's try everything, including werewolf sounds.
Yeah.
I do love Gold Dust Woman, but, and this is a weird phenomenon. I think for an album where I'm like, yeah, every song's incredible. I have a clear favorite too. Like there's a song that's on there that like, I don't even have to think about it. The Chain is just like, boom, done. My favorite song on the record. And I can't think of another record where like, I love every song on it. But there's one song that's like immediately like no questions asked. I don't even have to debate. This is my favorite one.
For me, it's Go Your Own Way. But
And you know what? I couldn't argue with either. Yeah. I couldn't be like, oh, no, my choice is better than you. No, you're right. No, that is
a great
song.
You're still right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like your favorite is just as valid as my favorite. And that there's no way I would try to convince you otherwise.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to keep talking about Rumors on the next album. On the next episode.
We should cut an album. Let's cut an album.
Yeah, we should.
You guys want to rent a studio at the Coke Pit and just kind of go for it?
Let's make our own Rumors. So do we have anything to plug before we get out of here? I would like to mention that I'm doing comedy again for the first time on February 3rd at the Sardine in San Pedro. Come watch, please. Anything else?
I don't got nothing.
I have new episodes of Look Good for the Boys and Ghoul School on the way, and that's about it.
Very nice. All right, let's get the fuck out of here. Andy, say goodbye.
Ah, goodbye.
Travis, how about you say goodbye?
Arr, goodbye, mateys.
Goodbye, everybody. We love you.